think about the way the world is and the way that the world could be.
All of our systems are interrelated and interdependent.
There's 1,000 different voices that nobody hears.
We're looking at a human being, and there's life story.
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 Story. Story. Story. Story.
Connection to the people we don't know that live near us.
An Elevated Denver starts now.
Welcome back to the Elevated Denver podcast, where we shine a light on stories and solutions shaping the future of homelessness in our city. After 30 episodes and 2 powerful seasons, we took a short pause to focus on another side of our work, our collaboratories, where community members, service providers, and leaders come together to co-design real solutions. Now we're back with something special, a 2-episode series featuring the Denver Basic Income Project. We'll explore what basic income really means, how it's being tested here in Denver, and why it could change the way we think about poverty, stability, and opportunity in America. We're joined today by a special guest. Gwen, could you please introduce yourself?
Hi, my name is Gwen Battis, and I am the project manager for the Denver Basic Income Project.
The Denver Basic Income Project has a new documentary coming out. What story are you hoping people walk away with after watching it?
I'm hoping that folks who view our film walk away with either a new or a renewed belief in not only the power of direct cash, but also the power of people, specifically the power of people when they're given agency, dignity, and opportunity. We speak in the film with 3 unique individuals, all DBIP participants, Elle, Chantel, and Charlie, and we hear about their lives before, during, and after receiving cash and being part of the Denver Basic Income Project. Each of their stories vary. They come from different backgrounds. They have unique struggles and barriers they face in their lives. And they also have different ideas of what success looks like in their future. But I think what's unifying about all of that is that as a society, we all have goals for the future and understand that it takes a lot of work to get there. And a lot of the systemic and structural places we find ourselves make that hard, really hard to achieve. So I'm hoping through the transformational power of cash and the way it's explored in the documentary, people can walk away feeling hopeful and determined for creating a type of society where this type of intervention can thrive and we see that investing in people is worth it.
Why do you think it's important to tell the story now, in this moment here in Denver and nationally?
We started thinking about creating a documentary. And we started ideating about this in late winter, early spring of this year and kind of went into action pretty quickly. But I think as things in our country started to evolve, I actually think there was never a more important time than right now to tell this story. We're approaching a time in this country where even the most fundamental basic needs for Americans will be out of reach. They'll be pushed further out of reach. I think we're approaching a time where the conversation's shifting. It's not left versus right. It's not this like ideological war within our country. It's more a class war. There's a war on people in poverty right now. There's a war on everyday working American people. And this is a story of what it means to give people exactly what they need, which is trust and a financial foundation. And they're able to do with that what they will. They can make their own choices in life. They're really able to set their own goals and build upon those. In Denver specifically, the post-COVID expansion and just crazy rise in homelessness is what brought DBIP to be. I think currently talking about these participants and like the times we find ourselves in right now, even the difficulty it is to fund projects like this, it couldn't be more timely. And I hope that telling the story of a small grassroots organization running a pilot at this scale could demonstrate to viewers what's possible if we could take this nationwide.
Yeah, it's almost like what happens when we view each other as individuals with agency and dignity and recognize that those of us sitting here right now are not being asked what we spend our money on or how we operate in our daily lives and what would happen if we entrusted that to everybody. That goes back to the origin of the Denver Basic Income Project. Let's hear from Mark Donovan, the founder of DBIP, about how and why he started this project and the impact they saw on the pilot.
Really goes back to right around 2020, as COVID was starting to impact folks and things were shutting down. And I was seeing this juxtaposition of two things happening. I was seeing, on the one hand, folks losing their stability, their housing, their income. And on the other side, I was seeing people with wealth seeing their net worth soaring. And I felt compelled to take action and to do something. And that summer, I started to experiment with the idea of giving people cash directly and unconditionally. And I did that through the end of the year and started to do a deep dive into the literature on this and the work that had come before it. And I realized that this was a really powerful and underutilized intervention, especially as it related to people experiencing homelessness, and decided in January of that year to commit additional personal resources and to raise funds to explore this idea of giving people experiencing homelessness unconditional cash with trust and dignity and respect, and exploring what would happen. Stepped up and matched the initial seed funds and gave us the basis to start doing this work. And we did it initially at small scale, but ultimately we deployed $10.8 million to more than 800 people experiencing homelessness in Denver and produced some groundbreaking results. We've seen families reunited. We've seen people move from the streets to housing. We've seen people move from despair to hope. So just watching the impact of trusting people and providing some resources and a phone and a connection to other resources and organizations, if that's what they need and want, it's been just amazing to watch and to be a part of.
Back to Gwen to talk more about the impact of the DBIP pilot and other universal basic income projects across the country, and how the results really combat many stereotypes and misconceptions about homelessness.
There's a lot of misconceptions about homelessness. And when you combine that with an idea like basic income, it's like an explosion of tropes and stereotypes that are so pervasive in our society. Like, people are homeless because they don't want to work, because it's a choice. There's opportunities presented to them and they're choosing not to take them. Therefore, it's like their own kind of personal failings that keep them in this place. And the same kind of messaging can be found across other pilots, people saying you give them a basic income and they're not going to work. It's going to disincentivize people from going out and finding employment. And the data speaks for itself. Across all the pilots in the U.S., many have found concrete evidence over and over again that a basic income removes the barriers to getting good quality work, which makes sense, right? If you're given $1,000 a month and you're experiencing homelessness, maybe that pays for you to take a shower in the morning, to pay for a bus to get to a job interview or to your job. Maybe you could buy a car. People also fail to recognize that when you go and apply for a job, they ask for a number of things. They ask for documents. You have to fill out tax information. You need your social security card, your birth certificate, or your driver's license. That is pretty hard to hold on to when you're experiencing homelessness. It also costs money to replace those documents. On top of, there's a fee a lot of times to apply for housing or for a job. You have to put down a phone number. There's all these things that I think people don't realize that make it just so difficult in 2024 in our year one quantitative report. The participants who received larger sums of money per month, so that would be Group A or B. Group A is $1,000 per month. Group B received $6,500 up front, and then $500 a month for the subsequent 11 months, both saw an increase in full-time employment in just 10 months. Another study that's well-known and spearheaded a lot of momentum in the basic income movement was out of Stockton, California, Mayor Michael Tubbs. They also found that full-time employment increased because the UBI gave people time to find and apply for better jobs. You actually have some breathing room and flexibility to say, actually, I'm going to do the extra training or education to get this more stable. Maybe it's better hours. I can spend more time with my family, better paying job. And that's the path that really leads to stability. I think that's one misconception. I think the second that we hear over and over and over again is people are just going to spend money on drugs and alcohol. It's a tiresome stereotype that's perpetuated over and over when really the statistics of people falling into homelessness because of addiction or substance use is relatively low. And a lot of folks just anecdotally have told me it is because of this project that I'm sober. I think that's something I want a lot of people to hear and really internalize. I think we like to label somebody who has addiction or mental health issues as this is just the loop they're perpetually going to be stuck in, when really you give an opportunity of a different path or a different future. There's money coming in every month where you can make different choices for yourself. Most of the time, people are going to want to make different choices for themselves.
I got to believe that there's a component that's much harder to measure there about what happens when people feel like someone believes in them and trusts them to do what they know they need. A lot of our research pointed to people becoming unhoused and then that actually prompting substance use or triggering mental health challenges. And once you get stuck in that loop where you're barely able to access the most basic services, it's really challenging and that can kick into that cycle. When someone steps in and says, you know what, we know you've fallen on hard times, it's really challenging, but we believe in you, that makes a huge difference.
I think you're exactly right in the sense that I think a lot of people conflate who you might see in your neighborhood experiencing a substance use or mental health issue as that's the reason that they're there. That's what put them in that position. So I think we're looking at two things that aren't correlated in the way that people think that they are. And I don't think we're really giving people the dignity that they deserve of how traumatic of an experience that is.
We're going to take a short break to tell you about a special event this December that you can be a part of. On December 21st, Colorado Coalition for the Homeless will be hosting their annual vigil to support all lives lost to homelessness this year. For the first time ever, the Memorial Blanket Project will be here, displaying blankets we all make for our unhoused neighbors, just like a local Girl Scout troop.
My whole Girl Scout troop is designing squares
so that a family can have a blanket this winter.
We're going to give them the blanket so they can stay warm during the winter.
And what are you doing on your blanket square?
I'm putting some turtles, a smiley face, a frog, and a flower to like just make bright colors to make people happy.
And why is it important to help people?
Because if they don't have a home, then it can be hard to live and they can kind of suffer. So we're helping them so it's easier to live.
And think about this. How would you feel if you were out there all winter without anything warm?
We need more blankets. So if you've ever thought about sewing, knitting, crocheting, or even tying a blanket, we need you. Check out our website to learn more about the blanket sizes, where you can bring them, and any other questions you have. ElevatedDenver.co, like Colorado. Join us in keeping our neighbors warm this winter. Now back to the episode. What do you see as the biggest barrier to acceptance?
There's countless pilots that have popped up in the last 10 years, and I think we've given more than enough of a body of evidence that this works. But I think largely and narratively, we need to combat this idea of who's deserving and the kind of like handout mentality that's really pervasive in politics right now. I think it's worth mentioning that our social safety net was developed primarily in the 1930s with FDR and the New Deal. It's been expanded upon over time. But if you're examining what maybe a single mom of two kids got in 1995 versus today, it's really not all that different. The adjustment to benefits is astonishing. I don't think people are realizing that. I also don't think the average person really thinks about what might happen if the COVID pandemic checks that we all got happen regularly. Like, what would you be able to do? Would you be able to pay off your debt? A lot of us have student loans. A lot of us have loans of mortgages, car payments. Maybe you owe debt to a friend. There's hospital bills. There's so many things that build up in this country and the way our economy is designed that who's deserving is something that I struggle with in talking about. If your parents were able to pay for your college fully, or maybe they gave you a car in high school when you got your driver's license, is that a handout? Or is that just like a benefit of the circumstances in which you were born? I think there's something we have to grapple with as a society to really get on board with the idea that everyone is deserving of healthcare, housing, food, shelter, all these things we identify as human rights. When it comes time in practice, what does it mean to actually give people those things? There's a really big hang up on giving cash, not just services, I think is extremely divisive because of handout mentality of what did you do to earn it? How did you work for it? We get asked pretty often, what are the work requirements for the Denver Basic Income Project? There's none. You just get it because you're a person and you deserve it. And you get to use it however you want. I think that seems revolutionary, but in essence, I don't think it's really innovative or revolutionary at all. I think it's the most primitive, what do people in poverty need? They need money.
Perhaps the most humane thing, really.
Yeah, instead of this paternalistic approach that we're taking that isn't working really well. We have much more poverty than other developed nations in the world, but we also invest a fraction of what other developed nations invest in supportive services. I think that's a really big systemic barrier to broader acceptance.
And you brought up basic needs and how those aren't being attended to. I was thinking about a Denver Basic Income Project participant that we have interviewed here at the Elevated Denver podcast, Charlie, who will also be in the film. Part of Charlie's story is working and having kids and doing everything she can. And there's just not enough to meet those basic needs of shelter and food, not to mention healthcare, childcare. There are a lot of other things that intersect with homelessness and often contribute to the experience of homelessness that we forget about and don't attend to systemically that lead people into a path of not being able to afford what should be their human right. Maybe you could share with us what you found the cost is to provide basic income to folks on an annual basis versus the cost of someone needing support completely from the system.
So if you're looking at groups A and B in DBIP, both of those groups got $12,000 over the course of 1 year. We know $1,000 can't fully cover the rent in Denver, but it's meant as a hefty supplement. Now, there's a number of different research institutions, the city, a couple of think tanks as well, that's speculated. What is the total cost per person in their interactions with the system? And that number floats around like $70,000 per year that the city spends in terms of staying in a shelter, emergency room visits, healthcare, spending the night in jail. The cost savings is great. And that's not to make the case cash can just do it alone, because many, if not all, of our participants found real need and resources that help them in supplementing the cash they received. It can't just act alone. This is not meant to be a replacement for the services that we provide, but we know the services are a policy choice made decades ago to keep people in poverty. We know people need supplemental income in the form of cash to be able to have mobility economically, to make different choices for themselves. We do have cost analysis research in our year one report, and I think the total was around $600,000.
In that year in cost savings.
And they thought that that estimate was relatively low. So I think it's definitely something.
One thing I really like that you said is cash isn't going to do it on its own, but perhaps it provides the opportunity for the safety net, that bed of supports and services, to be a temporary landing spot for people as it was supposed to be. The safety net as a concept was something that catches you when you fall and bolsters you back up. It's not doing that now, but the possibility is there when you do the basic cash or basic income.
Right now, we have a really dire set of circumstances, but also a possible opening where we're talking about affordability and we're talking about the systems that have been broken for a long time, because what's in jeopardy and what's happening is they're being made even worse. And the unfathomable idea that we could stoop this low and not protect the interests of everyday Americans. I think there is a pathway to kind of getting more broad support. And I think it lies in framing it as we have a huge gap in wages. We have folks who work several jobs who are on benefits. And then once they make too much money, they lose their benefits, but they can't afford healthcare privately. There's so many flaws in how the system's constructed that I think, if anything, the silver lining right now is bringing that to the forefront of the conversation.
It's clear we're living through a moment of massive transition. That's why the basic income conversation feels more timely than ever. In our next episode, we'll continue our conversation with Gwen Battis from the Denver Basic Income Project. We'll talk about what it takes to shift mindsets, what we can learn from their upcoming documentary, and how basic income might just help us build a future rooted in dignity, equity, and connection. How can people follow along?
If you don't already follow us on social media, primarily Instagram and TikTok, it's just at Denver Basic Income Project. And sign up for our newsletter. We'll be putting out invites to the screening and materials through those channels.
Thanks for listening. We hope this episode deepened your understanding of the Denver Basic Income Project and inspired you to see the upcoming documentary. We're at a critical inflection point as a nation, and projects like this show what's possible when we invest in people's dignity and well-being. If this conversation moved you, don't miss the DBIP's documentary, and please share this episode. This episode was brought to you by the Denver Basic Income Project and Elevated Denver. Editing, sound design, and music by Jesse Boynton. Recording and production by the Olympic Recording Studio. To learn more, visit elevateddenver.co. Sign up for our newsletter and reach out if you're interested in being part of the solution. It's going to take all of us to build an elevated Denver.